The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
When Juno Diaz started contributing to The New Yorker around 20 years ago, his stories were like a shot of adrenaline to the heart. They're fast, they're vivid and racy, fantastic storytelling. But both in their language and their politics, they also served many readers as an introduction to the culture of Dominicans in the United States. Diaz has been ferocious about criticizing the Dominican Republic, in particular, its treatment of workers and immigrants from the adjoining nation of Haiti. He's written on this issue for many years, and recently he compared new rules about deporting Haitians to something out of Nazi Germany. So, Juno, what is your argument with the Dominican Republic?
Well, it's not with the Dominican Republic. It's with this political party that's engineered a retroactive change to the Dominican Constitution. You know, you're only a Dominican if you can trace your Dominicanness to parents before 1930s. And it was basically this reading was engineered to target Haitian Dominicans as part of a larger kind of policies and larger politics to isolate, marginalize, and menace the larger Haitian immigrant community in the Dominican Republic.
Juno, you're a favorite son of the Dominican Republic. You were born there in 1968. You've won all kinds of awards. In 2009, you were awarded an Order of Merit by the Dominican Republic, by the government. And now you were stripped of that Order of Merit.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't describe a writer as a favorite son of any country. Certainly not. But
there has to be enormous national pride that you've risen to such prominence as a novelist and a writer of short stories here.
Well, I think you have to understand the kind of culture of the Dominican Republic. If I was a baseball player and a bachatero, I think that you would have the country would have a wider sense of who I am. Again, I'm very minor figure, and I'm not just saying that out of humility. It's true, very minor figure. But we're talking about a political elite that I've tried everything possible to stay as far away from. And I'm not surprised that suddenly these very folks who gave me a medal, which I never claimed, suddenly discovered that they hadn't read anything I'd written. Because certainly if they'd read anything I'd written, I would be the last person that they would be trying to give, these politicians would be trying to give awards to.
You know, the late John Updike said that in a writer's early career, that you're able to almost easily work off the memory of your life. You left at 6 years old, which is a very critical pivot time in any person's life. What the motherlode of memory from the Dominican Republic was that you were able to retain before 6 years old is, for some people at least, pretty slim. How much of it was real memory of life lived there, and how much of it was kind of received through lore and your mother or other relatives and the rest?
Yeah, I think it was multiple. I think there was a real memory. There was sort of fantastic memory. Certainly, one of the things that ends up helping is that when you grow up in an immigrant enclave, when you grow up in a Dominican sort of milieu, there's more continuity than you would have expected. So, of course, I'm sitting surrounded by all these Dominicans in New Jersey, many of them who don't speak English, many of them who, even if they've been living in the States for 5, 6, 7, 8 years, you would think that they had just gotten here from the Dominican Republic. And in some ways, it kind of helped focus my recollections of the Dominican Republic. I think part of what ended up happening with me, David, was that I was a kid whose father was in the United States while I was living in the Dominican Republic.
He preceded you here by some years, right?
Exactly. And so I spent my first 6 years of my life dreaming of another place. I was always thinking and dreaming about this father in America. Well, what ends up happening is that I come to the United States and suddenly my entire Dominican world is gone. It's vanished. It's like, you know, Superman Krypton being just exploded. And suddenly I just swapped from sort of longing and trying to imagine and trying to connect with an America that was distant to I started doing the same for the Dominican Republic. It was linked to relatives like my grandparents, who I loved. It was linked to a time of safety. You know, being an immigrant is incredibly hard. You know, being in America was for many years a source of great pain, the pain of, you know, acculturation, of learning language, of that shock of American xenophobia and racism. And so, of course, that my mind and my heart would cast itself back to the Dominican Republic and that I would have these muscles that would enable that.
What were your experiences of racism as a kid? How to describe it to somebody who's not living the same life as you?
My first experience is that I came over in December 1974. So, of course, in the first 6 months that I was in the United States, I watched the last remnants of the American imperial project in Vietnam collapse.
And you're aware of it at age six?
Well, because you're learning English and you have the TV on,
right,
and all that is on television is Vietnam. I always tell my friends, I'm like, the first word I learned in English was Vietnam. And it was amazing, some of the kind of racial just madness that, you know, that was, you know, just part of the kind of vocabulary of America in that time around Asians and around Asian Americans. I mean, I think I learned all the racist terms for Asians in those first 12 months because of that kind of trauma and that history that America had vis-a-vis Vietnam.
Well, it's funny. You just mentioned before that the experience of being plopped down here was almost a science fiction kind of experience from one world to the next. And part of your early reading and sometimes your attempts at writing are in the science fiction vein. Now, I'm a bit older than you, but we grew up with one science fiction thing in common. You love it. I've seen them all, but I cannot fathom it. I don't understand them. Please explain to me the importance of Star Wars to you.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because when one thinks about—
I have no idea. I have to tell you, I have no idea what's going on. I see them multiple times. Galaxies are exploding because people are searching for a map to see Mark Hamill. I have no idea what's going on.
Yeah, well, you know, if you've seen this the latest movie, even those of us who have a lot of literacy on Star Wars, I think it would be a far stretch to actually make sense of what's going on.
People love this one.
It's kind of a straightforward parable of masculinities and conflict. It is about boys and their fathers and male power and male superpowers, all the different ingredients of boys' adventure stories, swords, medievalism, bad dads, space travel. You know, it's in many ways, I'm telling you, all of the basic building blocks of kind of American popular mythology have found their home in Star Wars.
I got to tell you, Juno, the more I listen to you, the more it sounds like you want to write one of these sci-fi epics.
Oh, God, no, not in that vein. I think I recognize their hold they have on me, but I would not want to write them in that vein.
Now, a few years ago, you published a story in The New Yorker, and it was a story called Monstro, and you were thinking about turning that into something longer?
Yeah, I'm still wrestling with it. You know, it's kind of my take on zombies and monsters, you know, on the island where zombies and New World monsters first went into circulation. And so it was kind of my attempt to bring the kind of post-colonial zombie monster home to the Caribbean. But it keeps just kind of derailing. So I'll keep trying. I just keep having this idea of what would happen if the world ended in a country where the world has ended multiple times, where that's something, in fact, that we're quite used to. The United States, the world ending would be this singular tragedy. In the Dominican Republic, it's just a return to the normal.
How do you mean?
Well, I mean, Jesus, how many times has the world ended in the Caribbean? You know, you had the poor world ending for all the indigenous people when the Europeans came over and colonized and sort of through disease and through slavery and
the
violence.
Slave trade and
yeah, man, it's the apocalyptic core of the Caribbean is really, really deep. It's really deep, you know?
Do you know, I am dying to talk to you about the election. And in 2012, I remember you were on with Bill Moyers and you were impatient with Obama. You said that he had failed to tell a story. The other night at the State of the Union address, arguably he's telling his close to his final story. His, you know, he had an hour of airtime in which he's talking to the American people about his accomplishments, about his career as president. Where are you on him at this point?
My sense of Obama has always been that he's an atypical politician. Most politicians I know have at least some thirst for the conflict, that they have some kind of competitive edge, that they kind of like knocking heads a little bit, that it's hard to be a politician if you're not a slightly combative. And, you know, as a political figure, he's always struck me as far more melancholy than combative. As far as sort of what his narrative, other than the fact that he's Obama, his narrative has been disorganized. It's really hard to put a finger on. If you're somehow connected to the vast Latino communities in the United States, when you think of what his legacy is going to be, it was a nightmare.
I mean, tell me why you think so.
Well, I mean, I don't think it's just exaggeration that people call him the deporter in chief. I think numbers hold up. The politics around immigration that were enacted by his administration, that's, I think, something that is hard to square with a guy who himself presents and has a discourse very humanistic, very tolerant, very patient. You know, I'm always divided. I'm someone of African descent. I'm Latino and I'm an immigrant. And while the symbolic victory that Obama represents is something very dear to me, the kind of injurious politics that his administration, you know, underwrote are hard to forget. They're very hard to forget.
Do you know, maybe this is a complicated question to even ask, much less to answer, but when I got to The New Yorker, the Ur-writer here was somebody we didn't see very often, but wrote with incredible regularity, and that was John Updike. Every year there'd be a new book. Every several weeks, a perfectly honed critical essay. The fertility and the stream of work just began in the 50s and ended with a book of poems literally from his deathbed. It's intimidating. That kind of notion has to be intimidating to all of the writers. You've had your ups and downs with this. You've talked some about difficulty of getting a book launched or getting one launched for as long as a year or two and then setting aside, to put it politely. How do you deal with that? And do you feel it's a matter of block, or it's just a matter of that's who you are and that's how you're going to create and that's how you're going to go about it?
I think it's important that we have that kind of diversity. I think that I laud the Updikes and the Joyce Carol Oates, the Samuel R. Delaney's. We need people who live through their writing. But we also need the folks who are, you know, they kind of dwell in deep, deep places and emerge with pearls only, you know, once every few decades. And I think that
How do you see your own life in those terms?
I think I see my life as someone who has to generate a lot of crap to get anything good out. It happens, man.
And it doesn't get easier.
I don't think it has. I think what I've come to learn is that one book or 40, the books that you don't write are simply opportunities for people to read other writers. And that helps, man. I mean, I'm slow and I've had to kind of, you know, fight with that, my lust and desire, my longing to write faster. But the slow dawning that we have the rhythm that we need to create the art that matters to us and hopefully to other people. You cannot wish another rhythm on yourself. You can maybe work to try to get it, but I've learned to understand and begin to appreciate that I was given this rhythm for a reason. There are things that need to be written that can only be written by a slowpoke like me, and I sort of I take comfort in that.
Pulitzer Prize-winning writer and slowpoke, Junot Diaz. His most recent book is This Is How You Lose Her. You can read some of his stories at newyorkerradio.org.